how they couldn't possibly come for the capsule, because some of them seemed to be miles away. Once again, nobody on the ground was interested. They weren't interested on Kenton Island, and pretty soon he was in range of that station on Hawaii, and they weren't interested either. They were all wrapped up in something else. They had a little surprise for him. They backed into it, however. It took him a while to catch on. He was now 4 hours and 21 minutes into the flight. In 12 minutes, the retro rockets were supposed to fire to slow him down for re-entry. It took him another minute and 45 seconds to go through all the do-you-reads and how-me's and overs and establish contact with the Capcom on Hawaii. Then they sprang their surprise. Friendship 7, said the Capcom. We have been reading an indication on the ground of Segment 5-1, which is landing bag deploy. We suspect this is an erroneous signal. However, Cape would like you to check this by putting the landing bag switch in auto position and seeing if you get a light. Do you concur with this? Over. It slowly dawned on him. Have been reading. For how long? Quite a little surprise. And they hadn't told him. They held it back. I am a pilot, and they refuse to tell me things they know about the condition of the craft. The insult was worse than the danger. If the landing bag had deployed, and there was no way he could look out and see it, not even with a periscope, because it would be directly behind him, if it had deployed, then the heat shield must be loose and might come off during reentry. If the heat shield came off, he would burn up inside the capsule like a steak. If he put the landing bag switch in the automatic control position, then a green light should come on if the bag was deployed. Then he would know. Slowly it dawned. That's why they kept asking him if the switch were in the off position. They didn't want him to learn the awful truth too quickly. Might as well let him complete 3 orbits. Then we'll let him find out about the bad news. On top of that, they now wanted him to fool around with a switch. That's stupid. It might very well be that the bag had not deployed, but there was an electrical malfunction somewhere in the circuit, and fooling with the automatic switch might then cause it to deploy. But he stopped short of saying anything. Presumably, they had taken all that into account. There was no way he could say it without falling into the dread, nervous chatter. Okay, said Glenn. If that's what they recommend, we'll go ahead and try it. Are you ready for it now? Yes, when you're ready. Roger. He reached forward and flipped the switch. Well, this was it. No light. He immediately switched it back off. Negative, he said. In automatic position, did not get a light, and I'm back in off position now. Over. Roger, that's fine. In this case, we'll go ahead and the re-entry sequence will be normal. The retro rockets would be fired over California, and by the time the retro rockets brought him down out of his orbit and through the atmosphere, he would be over the Atlantic, near Bermuda. That was the plan. Wally Schirab was the Capcom in California. Less than a minute before he was supposed to fire the retro rockets by pushing a switch, he heard Wally saying, John, leave your retro pack on through your pass over Texas. Do you read? Roger. But why? The retro pack wrapped around the edges of the heat shield and held the retro rockets. Once the rockets were fired, the retro pack was supposed to be jettisoned. They were back to the heat shield again with no explanation, but he had to concentrate on firing the retro rockets. Next to the launch, this was the most dangerous part of the flight. If the capsule's angle of attack was too shallow, you might skip off the top of the Earth's atmosphere and stay in orbit for days until long after your oxygen had run out. You wouldn't have any more rockets to slow you down. If the angle were too steep, the heat from the friction of going through the atmosphere would be so intense you would burn up inside the capsule, and a couple of minutes later the whole thing would disintegrate. Heat shield or no heat shield. But the main thing was not to think about it in quite those terms. The field of consciousness is very small, said Saint-Exupéry. What do I do next? It was the moment of the test pilot at last. Oh yes, I've been here before, and I am immune. I don't get into corners I can't get out of. One thing at a time. He could be a true flight test hero and try to line the capsule up all by himself by using the manual controls with the horizon as his reference, or he could make one more attempt to use the automatic controls. Please, dear God, don't let me foul up. What would the Lord answer? Try the automatic, you ninny. He released and reset the gyros. He put the controls on automatic. The answer to your prayers, John. Now the dials jibed with what he saw out the window and through the periscope. The automatic controls worked perfectly in pitch and roll. The yaw was still off, so he corrected that with the manual controls. The capsule kept pivoting to the right, and he kept nudging it back. The Alpha Trainer. One thing at a time. It was just like the Alpha Trainer. No sense of forward motion at all. As long as he concentrated on the instrument panel and didn't look at the Earth sliding by beneath him, he had no sense at all of going 17,500 miles an hour or even 5 miles an hour. The humming little kitchen. He sat up in his chair, squirting his hand thruster, with his eyes pinned on the dials. Real life. A crucial moment. Against the eternal good beige setting of the simulation. One thing at a time. Shara began giving him the countdown for firing the rockets. 5, 4. He nudged it back one more with the yaw thruster. 3, 2, 1. Fire. He pushed the retro rocket switch with his hand. The rockets started firing in sequence. The first one, the second one, the third one. The sound seemed terribly muffled, but in that very moment, the jolt, pure gold. One instant, as Shara counted down, he felt absolutely motionless. The next, thud, 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 the jolt in his back. He felt as if the capsule had been knocked backwards. He felt as if he were sailing back toward Hawaii. All as it should be, pure gold. The retro light was lit up green. It was all going perfectly. He was merely slowing down. In 11 minutes, he would be entering the Earth's atmosphere. He could hear Shara saying, "Keep your retro pack on until you pass Texas." Still, no reason given. He couldn't see the pattern yet. There was only the dim sense that in some fashion they were jerking him around, but all he said was, "That's affirmative." "It looked like your attitude held pretty well," said Shara. "Did you have to back it up at all?" "Oh, yes, quite a bit, yeah. I had a lot of trouble with it." "Good enough for government work from down here," said Shara. That was one of Shara's favorite lines. "Do you have a time for going to jettison retro?" said Glenn. This was an indirect way of asking for some explanation for the mystery of keeping the retro pack on. "Texas will give you that message," said Shara. "Over." They weren't going to tell him. Not so much the thought as the feeling of the insult began to build up. 3 minutes later, the Texas Capcom tracking station came in. "This is Texas Capcom Friendship 7. We are recommending that you leave the retro package on through the entire re-entry. This means that you will have to override the 0.05G switch, which is expected to occur at 04:43:53. This also means that you will have to manually retract the scope. Do you read?" That did it. "This is Friendship 7, said Glenn. "What is the reason for this? Do you have any reason? Over. "Not at this time," said Texas Capcom. "This is the judgment of Cape Flight. We'll give you the reason for this action when you are in view. Roger, Friendship 7. It was really unbelievable. It was beginning to fit. 27 seconds later, he was over the Cape itself, and the Cape Capcom, with the voice of Alan Shepard on the radio, was telling him to retract his periscope manually and to get ready for a re-entry into the atmosphere. It was beginning to fit together. He could see the pattern, the whole business of the landing bag and the retro pack. This had been going on for a couple of hours now, and they were telling him nothing. merely giving him the bits and pieces. But if he was going to re-enter with the retro pack on, then they wanted the straps in place for some reason, and there was only one possible reason. Something was wrong with the heat shield. And this they would not tell him. Him, the pilot. It was quite unbelievable. It was... He could hear Shepard's voice. He was winding in the periscope, and he could hear Shepard's voice. While you're doing that, we are not sure whether or not your landing bag has deployed. We feel it is possible to re-enter with a retro package on. We see no difficulty at this time in that type of re-entry. Glenn said, Roger, understand. Oh, yes, he understood now. If the landing bag was deployed, that meant the heat shield was loose. If the heat shield was loose, then it might come off during the re-entry, unless the retro pack straps held it in place long enough for the capsule to establish its angle of re-entry, and the straps would soon burn off. If the heat shield came off, then he would fry. If they didn't want him, the pilot, to know all this, then it meant they were afraid he might panic. And if he didn't even need to know the whole pattern, just the pieces, so he could follow orders, then he wasn't really a pilot. The whole sequence of logic clicked through Glenn's mind faster than he could have put it into words, even if he had dared utter it all at that moment. He was being treated like a passenger, a redundant component, a backup engineer, a boiler room attendant in an automatic system, like someone who did not have that rare and unutterably righteous stuff, as if the right stuff itself did not even matter. It was a transgression against all that was holy. All this in a single limbic flash of righteous indignation as John Glenn re-entered the Earth's atmosphere.
Seven, this is Cape, said Al Shepard. Over.
Go ahead, Cape, said Glenn. You're ground. You are going out. We recommend that you...
That was the last he could hear from the ground. He had entered the atmosphere. He couldn't feel the G-forces yet, but the friction and the ionization had built up, and the radios were now useless. The capsule was beginning to buffet, and he was fighting it with the controls. The fuel for the automatic system, the hydrogen peroxide, was so low he could no longer be sure which system worked. He was descending backwards. The heat shield was on the outside of the capsule, directly behind his back. If he glanced out the window, he could see only the blackness of the sky. The periscope was retracted, so he saw nothing on the scope screen. He heard a thump above him on the outside of the capsule. He looked up. Through the window, he could see a strap from the retro pack. The straps broke. And now what? Next, the heat shield. The black sky out the window began to turn a pale orange. The strap, flat against the window, started burning. And then it was gone. The universe turned a flaming orange. That was the heat shield beginning to burn up from the tremendous speed of the re-entry. This was something Shepard and Grissom had not seen. They had not re-entered the atmosphere at such speed. Nevertheless, Glenn knew it was coming. 500, 1,000 times he had been told how the heat shield would ablate, burn off layer by layer, vaporize, dissipate the heat into the atmosphere, send off a corona of flames. All he could see now through the window were the flames. He was inside a ball of fire. But a huge flaming chunk went by the window, a great chunk of something burning. Then another. Another. The capsule started buffeting. The heat shield was breaking up. It was crumbling, flying away in flaming chunks. He fought to steady the capsule with a hand controller. Fly by wire. But the rolls and yaws were too fast for him. The Alpha Trainer gone amok, inside a fireball, the heat. It was as if his entire central nervous system were now centered in his back. If the capsule was disintegrating and he was about to burn up, the heat pulse would reach his back first. His backbone would become like a length of red-hot metal. He already knew what the feeling would be like, and when. Now. But it didn't come. There was no tremendous heat, and no more flaming debris. Not the heat shield after all. The burning chunks had come from what remained of the retro pack. First the straps had gone, and then the rest of it. The capsule kept rocking and the G-forces built up. He knew the G-forces by heart. 1,000 times he had felt them on the centrifuge. They drove him back into the seat. It was harder and harder to move the hand controller. He kept trying to damp out the rocking motion by firing the yaw thrusters and the roll thrusters. But it was all too fast for him. They didn't seem to do much good, at any rate. No more red glow. He must be out of the fireball. 7 G's were driving him back into the seat. He could hear the cape cap come. "How do you read? Over." That meant he had passed through the ionosphere and was entering the lower atmosphere. "Loud and clear. How me?"
"Roger, reading you loud and clear. How are you doing?"
"Oh, pretty good."
"Roger, your impact point is within 1 mile of the uprange destroyer."
"Oh, pretty good." It wasn't Jaeger, but it wasn't bad. He was inside of 1.5 tons of non-aerodynamic metal. He was 100,000 feet up, dropping toward the ocean like an enormous cannonball. The capsule had no aerodynamic qualities whatsoever at this altitude. It was rocking terribly. Out the window, he could see a wild white contrail snaked out against the blackness of the sky. He was dropping at 1,000 feet per second. The last critical moment of the flight was coming up. Either the parachute deployed and took hold, or it didn't. The rocking had intensified. The retro pack. Part of the retro pack must still be attached, and the drag of it is trying to flip the capsule. He couldn't wait any longer. The parachute was supposed to deploy automatically, but he couldn't wait any longer. Rocking. He reached up to fire the parachute manually, but it fired on its own, automatically. First the drogue, and then the main parachute. He swung under it in a huge arc. The heat was ferocious, but the chute held. It snapped him back into the seat. Through the window, the sky was blue. It was the same day all over again. It was early in the afternoon on a sunny day out in the Atlantic near Bermuda. Even the landing bag light was green. There was nothing even wrong with the landing bag. There had been nothing wrong with the heat shield. There was nothing wrong with his rate of descent, 40 feet per second. He could hear the rescue ship chattering away over the radio. They were only 20 minutes away from where he would hit, only 6 miles. He was once again lying on his back in the human holster. Out the window, the sky was no longer black. The capsule swayed under the parachute, and over this way he looked up and saw clouds, and over that way, blue sky. He was very, very hot, but he knew the feeling. All those endless hours in the heat chambers, it wouldn't kill you. He was coming down into the water only 300 miles from where he started. It was the same day, merely 5 hours later, a balmy day, out in the Atlantic near Bermuda. The sun had moved just 75 degrees in the sky. It was 2:45 in the afternoon. Nothing to do but get all these wires and hoses disconnected. He had done it. He began to let the thought loose in his mind. He must be very close to the water. The capsule hit the water. It drove him down into his seat again, on his back. It was quite a jolt. It was hot in here. Even with the suit fan still running, the heat was terrific. Over the radio, they kept telling him not to try to leave the capsule. The rescue ship was almost there. They weren't going to try the helicopter deal again, except in an emergency. He wasn't about to attempt a water egress. He wasn't about to hit the hatch detonator. The Presbyterian pilot was not about to foul up. His pipeline to the dear Lord could not be clearer. He had done it. Annie Glenn had already had a taste of what it was going to be like, but the other 6 and their wives were not ready for it. It was as if some enormous tidal wave were heading for the Cape and the entire USA from out in the Atlantic, from the vicinity of Grand Bahama Island where John was being debriefed. Riding the crest like Triton was the freckle-faced god, John himself. Word got back that the sailors on the Noah, the ship that hauled the capsule with John in it out of the water, had painted white lines around his footprints on the deck after he walked from the capsule to a hatchway. They didn't want his footprints on their deck to ever disappear. Well, it just seemed like some sort of Goonie Swabo sentimentality, but that was only the beginning. Al Shepard and Gus Grissom didn't know what the hell was happening. Poor Gus, all he had gotten after his flight was a medal, a handshake, a gust of rhetoric from James Webb out on a brain-frying strip of asphalt at Patrick Air Force Base, plus a few attaboys from a crowd of about 30. For John, well, the mobs that had showed up for the launch for the fireworks barely seemed to have thinned out at all. Cocoa Beach was still full of crazy adrenaline of the event. Out-of-towners were still tooling around all over the place in their automobiles and asking where the astronauts hang out. They didn't want to miss a thing. They knew that John would be flying back to the Cape after the debriefing. The next thing they knew, Lyndon Johnson was in town. He was going to meet John at the landing strip at Patrick. Underlings like Webb would just be part of the scenery. Then they learned that the president was coming, John F. Kennedy himself. Glenn wasn't going to him in Washington. He was coming to Glenn. Something quite extraordinary was building up. It was a wave and a half, and the other six and their wives were more surprised than anybody else. It was ironic. They had all assumed that Al Shepard was the big winner. Al had won out in the competition for the first flight. Al had been invited to the White House to receive a medal, whereas Gus had gotten his about 8 steps from the palmetto grass because Al was the certified number one man in this thing and had taken the first flight. But even before John got back to the Cape from Grand Bahama Island, there was a note of worshipful swooning in the air that indicated that Al had not made the first flight after all. He had merely made the first suborbital flight, which now looked like nothing at all. He was now more than Slick Goodland to John's Chuck Yeager. Slick Goodland had, technically, made the first flight of the X-1, but it was Yeager who made the flight that counted, the flight in which they first tried to push the bird supersonic. As Slick Goodland to John's Chuck Yeager, what was Al supposed to do? Cheer about it? And Betty Grissom, who never even got a parade down the poor, dim, dowdy main street of Mitchell, Indiana, was she supposed to be tickled pink about the Glens, who were going to be paraded up and down every high road in the United States? But there was precious little time to brood. Once John's plane touched down at Patrick on February 23rd, the wave became so big it simply carried everyone along with it. The fellows and the wives and the children were all out at Patrick waiting for John's plane, and the vice president was on hand along with 200 reporters. Johnson was right up there at the head of the mob with Annie and the two children. He had gotten next to her at last. Johnson was right beside her now out at Patrick, oozing protocol all over her and craning and straining his huge swollen head around, draining to get at John and poor Texas all over him. The plane arrives and John disembarks. A tremendous cheer goes up, a cry from the throat, from the diaphragm, from the solar plexus, and they bring Annie and the two children forward, the holy icons, the wife and the children, the solid backing on the home front, and John is too much. He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a handkerchief and dabs his eye, wipes away a tear. And some little guy from NASA stretched out his hand and took the used handkerchief so that it could be preserved in the Smithsonian. With this handkerchief, astronaut John H. Glenn Jr. wiped away a tear upon being reunited with his wife after his historic Earth orbital flight. From that moment on, Al and Gus were also Rans, minor leaguers, and they didn't even have time to fume. The events, day by day, were becoming like something elemental, like a huge change in the weather, a shift in the templates, the flood, the last day, the true brother entering heaven. John did not merely get a parade and a trip to the White House and the medal from the president. Oh, he got those things all right, but he also addressed a special joint session of Congress. The Senate and the House met together to hear John the way they had for presidents, prime ministers, kings. There was John standing up there at the podium with Lyndon Johnson and John McCormick seated beside him and the rest of them looking up at him from their seats in absolute adoration too. That was where the tears started. The tears. They couldn't hold them back. John's great round freckled face was shining with glory. He knew just what he was doing. He was the Presbyterian pilot addressing the world. He said some things that nobody else in the world could have gotten away with, even in 1962. He said, "I still get a lump in my throat when I see the American flag passing by." But he pulled it off, and then he lifted his hand up toward the gallery. This was in the House side of the Capitol, and 500 pairs of congressional eyes swung up with his hand toward the gallery, and he introduced his mom and dad from New Concord, Ohio, and a few aunts and uncles for good measure, and then his children, and finally, above all, "I want you to meet my wife, Annie. Annie the Rock." Well, that did it. That turned on the waterworks. Senators and representatives were trying to clap and reach for their handkerchiefs at the same time. They were dabbing their eyes and cheering through the fluttering ends of their handkerchiefs. Their faces glistened. Some fought back the tears, and a couple let go. They applauded, cheered, snuffled, wheezed. A couple of them said, "Amen." They said it out loud. It just came popping out of their good hardtack cracker evangelical dissenting Protestant hearts as the Presbyterian pilot lifted up his eyes and his hand to the Rock and the eternal mother of us all. And that was just the start. In a way, that was nothing compared to the ticker tape parade in New York. After all, a ceremonial joint session of Congress is a tailor-made event, a command performance, but the parade in New York was an amazing event. So amazing that anyone, even Al or Gus, could only blink and shake his head and ride the wave. John had the good sense to invite Al and Gus and the other four, Wally, Scott, Deke, and Gordo, and their families to join him and Annie and the children in the parade. John could have called the shot any way he wanted it. There was nobody in NASA or in the U.S. government, with the exception of Kennedy himself, who could have arranged it any way John didn't want it. So everybody came along for the show, the whole gang. Despite the tide of cheers and tears that had already started in Washington, none of them knew what to expect in New York. Like most military people, including those in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, they didn't really consider New York part of the United States. It was like a free port, a stateless city, an international protectorate. Danzig in the Polish Corridor, Beirut, the crossroads of the Middle East, Trieste, Zurich, Macau, Hong Kong. Whatever ideals the military stood for, New York City did not. It was a foreign city full of a strange race of curiously tiny, malformed gray people, and so forth and so on. What they saw when they got there bowled them over. The crowds were not only waiting in the airport, which was not surprising, a little publicity was all it took to get a mob of gawkers to an airport, but they were also lining the godforsaken highway into the city, through the borough of Queens, or whatever it was, out in the freezing cold in the most rancid, broken-down, industrial terrain you have ever seen, a decaying landscape that seemed to belong in another century. They were out there, along the highway, anywhere they could squeeze in, and they were crying. Crying as the black cars roared by. People were crying. Right out in the open, as soon as they laid eyes on John, and perhaps the rest of them too. They were all swept up in the wave now. The wave was too enormous for fine distinctions. When they reached the city proper, Manhattan, and came off the expressway, the FDR Drive, there were people hanging over the railings 20 or 30 feet up above the ramp, and they were crying and waving little flags and pouring their hearts out. And that was just the beginning. The parade started in Lower Manhattan and headed up Broadway. Each astronaut was in an open limousine. John led the lineup, of course, with Lyndon Johnson, vice president, in the seat beside him. It was cold as hell, 17 degrees, but the streets were mobbed. There must have been millions of people out there, packed from the curbings clear back to the storefronts, and there were people hanging out of all of the windows, particularly along Lower Broadway, where the buildings were older and they could open the windows, and they were filling the air with shreds of paper, every piece of paper they could get their hands on. Sometimes the pieces of paper would flutter right in front of your face, and you could see that they were tearing up their telephone books, just ripping the pages out and tearing them to bits and throwing them out the window as homage, as garlands, rose petals, and it was so touching. The horrible rat-gray city was suddenly touching. Warm. You wanted to protect these poor souls who loved you so much. Huge waves of emotion rolled over you. You couldn't hear yourself talk, but there was nothing, nothing you could have said anyway. All you could do was let these incredible waves roll over you. Out in the middle of the intersections were the policemen. The policemen they had all heard about or read about. New York's finest. Big, tough-looking men in blue greatcoats. And they were crying. They were right out there in the intersections in front of everybody. Bawling away, tears streaming down their faces, saluting, then cupping their hands and yelling amazing things to John and the rest of them. We love you, Johnny! We love you, Johnny! And then bawling some more, just letting it pour out. The New York cops. And what was it that had moved them all so deeply? It was not a subject that you could discuss, but the seven of them knew what it was. And so did most of their wives, or they knew about part of it. They knew it had to do with the presence, the aura, the radiation of the right stuff, the same vital force of manhood that had made millions vibrate and resonate 35 years before to Lindbergh. Except in this case, it was heightened by Cold War patriotism, the greatest surge of patriotism since the Second World War. Neither the term nor the concept of the single combat warrior did they know about, but the sheer patriotism of that moment, even in New York, the Danzig Corridor, was impossible to miss. We pay homage to you. You have fought back against the Russians in the heavens. There was something pure and rare about it. Patriotism. Oh, yes. Here you saw it in a million-footed form before your very eyes. Most of the seven had been around the Kennedys at one time or another with Jack or with Bobby and knew the way a crowd reacted to them. But it was something different from this. Around the Kennedys, you saw fans' hysteria involving a lot of shrieking and clutching with people reaching out to grab souvenirs and swooning and squealing as if the Kennedys were movie stars who happened to be in power. But what the multitude showed John Glenn and the rest of them on that day was something else. They anointed them with the primordial tears that the right stuff commanded. The seven righteous families were put up in suites at the Waldorf Astoria, which, as far as they knew, was still the grandest hotel in America. Suites. Two bedrooms and a living room. For junior officers in the military, it was an experience from a fable. They were still soaring on what they had just been through, but they were afraid to try to put the right name on it, afraid of what it might reveal about what was going through their minds. They were beginning to ask themselves the question, what precisely have we become? Henry Luce gave a dinner for them at the Tower Suite, the restaurant at the top of the Time Life building. After dinner, on the spur of the moment, the whole bunch of them went to see a play, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which was a big hit at the time. John and Annie and the children all of the other fellows and their wives and children, plus the bodyguards and some NASA people and some Time Life people, quite an entourage, and all of it arranged at the last minute. The start of the play was held up for them. People in the audience gave up their seats so the astronauts and their party could have the best seats in the house, a whole block. Just like that, they gave up their seats. When John and the others walked into the theater, everybody else was already seated because by now the play was a good 30 minutes late starting, and the audience rose and cheered until John sat down. Then a member of the cast came out in front of the curtain and welcomed them and congratulated John and praised the fellows as great human beings and humbly hoped that the little diversion about to be offered would please them. And now the play will commence. Then the lights went down and the curtain went up, and you had to be pretty dense not to realize what this was, a command performance. Royal treatment, point for point, right down the line, and they were the royal families. And it didn't stop there. They had rewritten some of the lines, rewritten them in an hour or so to make the jokes contain references to space and John's flight and putting a man on the moon and so on. When they left the theater, there were still other people outside waiting, hundreds more people, waiting in the cold, and they started yelling in those horrible, twisted, rat-gray New York street voices, but everything they said, even the wisecracks, was full of warmth and admiration. Christ, if they owned even New York, even this free port, this Hong Kong, this Polish corridor, what was not theirs now in America? Somehow, extraordinary as it was right. The way it should be. The unutterable aura of the right stuff had been brought onto the terrain where things were happening. Perhaps that was what New York existed for, to celebrate those who had it, whatever it was, and there was nothing like the right stuff. For all responded to it, and all wanted to be near it, and to feel the sizzle and to blink in the light. Oh, it was a primitive and profound thing. Only pilots truly had it, but the entire world responded, and no one knew its name. Not long after that, Kennedy brought the seven astronauts to the White House for a smaller, more personal visit. Kennedy's father was there, Joseph Kennedy. The old man had had a stroke and half his body was paralyzed, and he was sitting in a wheelchair. The president took the seven astronauts in to meet his father, and the first one he introduced him to was John. John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth and challenge the Russians in the heavens. The old man, Joe Kennedy, reaches up with his one good hand to shake hands with John, and suddenly he starts crying. But the thing is, only half his face is crying because of the stroke. One half of his face isn't moving a muscle. It's set absolutely impassive. But the other half, it's blubbering. That's the word for it. His eyebrow is curling down over his eye the way it does when you're really bawling. And the tears are streaming out of the crevice where his eyebrow and his eye and his nose come together. And one of his nostrils is quivering and his lips are writhing and contorting on that side. And his chin is all pulled up and pitted and trembling, but just on the one side. The other side is just staring at John, as if he saw right through him, as if he were just another Marine colonel whose career had somehow led him briefly into the White House. The president would lean down and put his arm around the old man's shoulders and say, now, Dad, it's all right. It's okay. But Joe Kennedy was still crying when they left the room. Obviously, if the man hadn't had a stroke, he wouldn't have burst out crying. Until his stroke, he had been a bear. Nevertheless, the emotion was there, and it would have been there whether he had had a stroke or not. But that is what the sight of John Glenn did to Americans at that time. It primed them for the tears, and those tears ran like a river all over America. It was an extraordinary thing, being the sort of mortal who brought tears to other men's eyes. Chapter 13. The Operational Stuff. July 4th was not the time of year for anyone to be introduced to Houston, Texas, although just what the right time would be was hard to say. For 8 months, Houston was an unbelievably torrid effluvial sump with a mass of mushy asphalt known as downtown set in the middle. Then, for 2 months, starting in November, the most amazing winds came sweeping down from Canada as if down a pipe, and the humid torpor turned into a wet chill. The remaining 2 months were the moderate ones, although not exactly what you would call spring. The clouds closed in like a lid, and the oil refineries over by Galveston Bay saturated the air, the nose, the lungs, the heart, and the soul with the gassy smell of oil funk. There were bays, canals, lakes, lagoons, bayous everywhere, all of them so greasy and toxic that if you trailed your hand in the water off the back of your rowboat, you would lose a knuckle. The fishermen used to tell the weekenders, "Don't smoke out there or you'll set the bay on fire." All the poisonous snakes known to North America were in residence there. Rattlers, copperheads, cottonmouths, and corals. No. There was no best time to be introduced to Houston, Texas, but July 4th was the worst. And it was on July 4th, 1962, that the seven Mercury astronauts moved to Houston. For the prodigious effort that Kennedy's moon program would require, NASA was building a manned spacecraft center on 1,000 acres of cattle pasture south of Houston near Clear Lake, which was not a lake but an inlet and was about as clear as the eyeballs of a poisoned bass. The astronauts, Gilruth, and most of the Langley and the Cape personnel would move to Houston, although the Cape would continue to be the launching center. The small scale and modest appearance of Langley and the Cape had somehow been perfect for the hell-for-leather, muscle-ah phase that Project Mercury had just been through. They all knew Houston would be bigger. The rest they could never have guessed. They stepped out of the airplane at the Houston airport and started gulping in the molten air. It was 96 degrees. Not that it mattered particularly. They had been assured that their entry into Houston would be easygoing and casual, Texas style. There would be a zippy little motorcade through downtown just to give the good folks a look-see, and then there would be a cocktail party with a few prominent local figures during which they could let their hair down and knock back a couple of long cool ones or whatever and relax. Waiting there at the airport is a lineup of convertibles, one for each astronaut and his family, with his name on a big paper banner taped to the side. So off they go in a motorcade, all seven of them and their wives and children, except for Joe Schirra, who was still at Langley recovering from some minor surgery. Pretty soon they're moving through the streets of Houston at a good clip, and it seems painless enough, but then all seven cars head down a ramp into the bowels of an arena called the Houston Coliseum. A bone-splitting chill hits them. They shudder and shake their heads. They are down inside some vast underground parking lot. The place is air-conditioned, Houston style, which is to say, within an inch of your life. There is a whole army of frozen people waiting down there in the gloaming, endless rows of marching bands in uniform, standing there like ice sculpture. Politicians waiting in yet more convertibles. Too cold to open their mouths, policemen, firemen, National Guard troops, stiff and still as lead, and more bands. Then they turn right around and head out of the underground parking lot, up the ramp, and back out into the blast of sunlight, 100 degrees of heat, and the asphalt, which was lying there, heaving and rippling in the caloric waves. All at once, they are at the head of a big parade through the streets of Houston. Well, not quite in the lead. In the lead convertible now is a Texas congressman. A rubicund fellow named Albert P. Thomas, an influential member of the House Appropriations Committee, waving a 10-gallon hat as if to say, "Look what I brought you!" It began to dawn on the boys and their wives that these people, the businessmen and the politicians, looked upon the opening of the manned spacecraft center and the arrival of the astronauts as about the biggest thing in Houston history. Neiman Marcus and all the other high-tone stores, the great banks and museums and other grand institutions, all the class, all the culture, were in Dallas. By Houston lights, Dallas was Paris. Once you set your watch to Central Standard, and Houston was nothing but oil and hard grabbers. The space program and the seven Mercury astronauts were going to make Boomtown respectable, legitimate, a part of America's soul. So the big parade began with Representative Albert Thomas's waving 10-gallon hat signaling the start of the redemption of Houston. The seven pilots and their wives thought that they had seen every sort of parade there was, but this one was sui generis. There were thousands of people lining the streets. They did not make a sound, however. They stood there four and five deep at the curbs, sweating and staring. They sweated a river and they stared ropes. They just stared and sweated. The seven lads, each in his emblazoned convertible, were standing up, grinning and waving, and the wives were smiling and waving, and the children were smiling and looking around. Everyone was doing the usual, and the crowds just stared back. They didn't even smile. They looked at them with a morose curiosity, as if they were prisoners of war or had come from Alpha Centauri, and no one was sure whether or not they comprehended the local lingo. Every now and then, some very old person would wave and yell something hearty and encouraging, but the rest were just planted there in the sun like tar babies. Of course, anyone fool enough to stand around in the asphalt mush of downtown at noon watching a parade was obviously defective to begin with. The parade plowed on, however, through wave after wave of catatonia and rippling lassitude. After about an hour of this, the fellows and their families noticed with considerable misgiving that the parade was heading back into that hole in the ground underneath the Colosseum. The air conditioning hit them like a wall. Everybody's bone marrow congealed. It made you feel like your teeth were loose. It turned out that this was where the little cocktail party was going to take place, in the Houston Colosseum. They led them up to the floor of the Colosseum, which was like a great indoor bowl. There were thousands of people milling about, and some sort of incredible smell, and a storm of voices and the occasional insane cackle. There were 5,000 extremely loud people on the floor, eager to tear into roast cow with both hands and wash it down with bourbon whiskey. The air was filled with the stench of burning cattle. They had set up about 10 barbecue pits in there, and they were roasting 30 animals. 5,000 businessmen and politicians and their better halves, fresh from the 100-degree horrors of downtown in July, couldn't wait to sink their faces in it. It was a Texas barbecue, Houston style. First, they took the seven brave lads and their wives and children up onto the stage that had been set up at one end of the arena, and there was a little welcoming ceremony in which they introduced them one by one, and a great many politicians and businessmen made speeches. All the while, the great cow carcasses sizzled and popped, and the smoke of the burning meat was wafted here and there in the chilly currents of the air conditioning. Only the extreme cold kept you from throwing up. The ganglia of the solar plexus were frozen. The wives tried to be polite, but it was a losing game. The children were squirming up on the stage, and the wives were getting up and whispering to any locals they could get close to. The children were in extremis. They hadn't been near a bathroom for hours. The wives were frantically trying to find out where the Johns were in this place. Unfortunately, now came the part where they were just supposed to relax, eat a side of beef and a peck of kidney beans, sinking in gravy, drink a little whiskey, and shake hands with the good folks and make themselves at home. So they led them back out onto the floor of the arena, cleared out a space, got some folding chairs for them and some paper plates loaded with huge joints of Texas steer, and then put a lineup of folding chairs around the whole group of them in a circle on the order of a stockade. And around the stockade, they put a ring of Texas Rangers facing outward toward the crowd. The crowd was now lining up by the hundreds at the barbecue pits, getting great lubricated hunks of beef on paper plates and more whiskey. Then they took seats in the stands, thousands of them, and looked down at the stockade floor. This was the main event, the reception, the big howdy. 5,000 people, VIPs one and all, sitting up in the stands of the Houston Coliseum amid the burning cattle, watching the astronauts eat. Certain VIPs with clout, however, were allowed to enter the stockade through the ring of rangers and greet the lads and their wives personally as they juggled the great maroon hunks of meat. It was always someone, such as Herb Snout from Car Castle, and he would come up and say, "Hi there, Herb Snout, Car Castle, listen, we're damn glad to have you folks here, just damn glad, goddammit." And then he would turn to one of the wives whose hands was so full of cow meat she couldn't budge, and he would bend down and turn on a huge Cairo syrup grin to show his deference to the ladies and say in a suddenly huge voice that would make the poor startled woman drop the reeking maroon all over her lap, "Hey there, little lady, just damn glad to see you too." And then he'd give a huge, horrible wink that would practically implode his eye, and he'd say, "We've heard a lot of good things about you gals, a lot of good things," all with his eye-wrenching wink. After a while, there were Herb Stouts and Gurney Franks all over the place, and the huge Hereford joints were sliding down every leg and splashing in the puddles of whiskey on the floor, and 5,000 spectators watched the struggling jaws and the smoke and the babble fill the air, and the children screamed for mercy and relief. Just then, when the madness seemed to have outdone itself once and for all, a band struck up. And the house lights dimmed, and a spotlight searched out the stage, and a show began, and a mighty, hearty voice boomed out over the PA system, "Ladies and gentlemen, in honor of our mighty special guest and mighty fine new neighbors, we are proud to present Miss Sally Rand." The band struck up Sugar Blues, much raunchy hi-hatting of the trumpets, oh, wow, 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 and out into the spotlight pranced an ancient woman with yellow hair and a white mask of a face. Her flesh looked like the meat of a cassava melon in the winter. She carried some enormous plumed fans. She began her famous striptease act, Sally Rand, who had been an aging but still famous stripper when the seven brave lads were in their teens during the Depression. Oh, wow, 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 wow. And she winked and minced about and took off a little here and covered up a little there and shook her ancient haunches at the seven single combat warriors. It was electrifying. It was quite beyond sex, show business, and either the sins or rigors of the flesh. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the 4th of July, and the cows burned on, and the whiskey roared, "Goddamn glad to see ya!" And the Venus de Houston shook her fanny in an utterly baffling blessing over it all. Just 3 years ago, Renee had still been in that dogged military wife's frame of mind in which you gladly spent 3 days sanding a slab of monkey pod until your hands were raw to save the fabulous sum of $95. When Scott had run up a $50 telephone bill calling her from Washington, Albuquerque, and Dayton during the testing back in 1959, it had seemed like the end of the world. $50. That was the food budget for a month. That was 3 years ago. Now she was in the living room of her own house, custom-made, not a tract home, on a lake, underneath the live oak and the pines. She and Annie Glenn had flown down to Houston one weekend from Washington and picked out lots, just like that. But they turned out to be in the best spot in the vicinity of the Space Center, a development called Timber Cove. The Shiraz and Grissoms had moved into the same neighborhood. With admirable foresight, as it turned out, they had built their houses so that they opened up in the back to look out on the water and the trees, while on the side facing the street, they were practically blank walls of brick. They had barely moved the first stick furniture in when the tour buses started arriving, plus the freelance tourists in cars. They were extraordinary, these people. Sometimes you could hear the loudspeaker inside the bus. You could hear the tour guide saying,
"This is the home of Scott Carpenter, the second Mercury astronaut to fly in Earth orbit and outer space."
Sometimes people would get out and grab handfuls of grass from your lawn. They'd get back on the bus with the miserable little green sprout sticking out of their fingers. They believed in magic. Sometimes people would drive up, get out, stare at the house as if waiting for something to happen, and then walk up to the door and ring the bell and say, "We hate to bother you, but do you suppose you could send one of your children out so we could have our pictures taken with him?" And yet, they weren't like the fans of movie stars. There was no frenzy. They thought they were really being considerate by not asking you to come out for the snapshot session yourself. They really meant it. They had more of the attitude of being at a living shrine. This was the first house that Renee and Scott had ever built. The first house that had really seemed theirs. They had turned the page all right. Things happened so fast now. At one point, it looked as if they were going to be given houses completely furnished. The best that $60,000 could buy in 1962 at wholesale. A month after John Glenn's flight, a Houston man named Frank Sharp presented to Leo D'Arcy as the fellow's business advisor the following proposition. To show their pride in the astronauts and the new manned space center, the builders, developers, furniture dealers, and others involved in the suburban home business would give each of the seven brave lads one of the homes being built for the 1962 parade of homes in Sharpstown. Sharpstown was a housing tract that Frank Sharp himself had been the impresario for. The parade of homes was a row of model houses that contractors who expected to do business in Sharpstown were putting up by way of advertising their wares. Sharp would contribute the land, a $10,000 lot to each astronaut. The contractors would contribute the houses, and the furniture and department stores would furnish them from top to bottom. The seven astronauts and their families would live right there on Rowan Drive in the Country Club Terrace section of Sharpstown, between Richmond Road and Bel Air Boulevard, and $60,000 worth of home and hearth each. Since Sharpstown at this point was nothing but maps, signs, bunting, Englishy, thatchy, tweedy-sounding street names and thousands of acres of windswept boondocker gumbo scrubland, Astronauts Row wouldn't be a bad way to start filling in the spaces. Sharp was a big howdy, through and through, a self-made man and already quite a prominent citizen, close to the mayor, Representative Albert Thomas, Governor John Connally, and Vice President Lyndon Johnson. He underwrote annual golf trophies and things of that sort. He had the right credentials, or the Houston version thereof, and so D'Arcy had talked it over with the boys, and they all decided the deal was okay. It had nothing to do with the space program and didn't obligate them to anything. It was just an unencumbered goody, pure and simple. None of them actually wanted to live in Sharpstown from what they had heard about the area. It was too far from the NASA facility for a start. So they figured they would accept the houses, shake hands with one and all, and then sell them. John Glenn was as agreeable to this type of goody as anybody else. It was that age-old concern of the military officer with the extras. John had been in the Marines for nearly 20 years now. He was too far down that road. He had been through too many measly paychecks to decondition himself anytime soon when it came to the perks, the extras, the irresistible and perfectly honorable and authorized goodies. Therefore, not even John, for all his quite sincere sense of morality, could comprehend the furor that was erupting. Gilruth and Webb and everybody else in the NASA hierarchy were blowing fuses over Frank Sharp's parade of the homes of the astronauts, and that was only the start. It had touched off a true emergency. The life deal was under review. From what Scott and the others had picked up, the president himself was considering putting an end to all commercial exploitation of astronaut status. The rest of the press had resented the life deal from the beginning and had argued that it cast a venal shadow on the astronauts' patriotic service. Sharpstown showed you where the exploitation route could lead. Sharpstown was one thing, but a threat to the life deal? Now there you had something serious. Unthinkable was the word. The seven pilots, steeped in the honorable goodies tradition of the military, had begun to look upon the life deal in the same way they looked upon the military pension that you rated after 20 years. It was an immutable condition of the service. It was part